College English Test, Band 4, Part 2, Listening Comprehension.
Section A. Directions. In this section, you will hear 8 short conversations and 2 long conversations. At the end of each conversation, 1 or more questions will be asked about what was said. Both the conversation and the questions will be spoken only once. After each question, there will be a pause. During the pause, you must read the 4 choices marked A, B, C, and D and decide which is the best answer. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center. Now, let's begin with the 8 short conversations.
Question 1.
I ran into Sally the other day. I could hardly recognize her. Do you remember her from high school?
Yeah, she was a little out of shape back then. Well, has she lost a lot of weight?
What does the man remember of Sally?
Question 2.
We don't seem to have a reservation for you, sir. I'm sorry.
But my secretary said that she had reserved a room for me here. I phoned her from the airport this morning, just before I got on board the plane.
Where does the conversation most probably take place?
Question 3.
What would you do if you were in my place?
If Paul were my son, I'd just not worry. Now that his teacher is giving him extra help and he's working harder himself, he's sure to do well in the next exam.
What's the man's suggestion to the woman?
Question 4.
You've had your hands full and have been overworked during the last 2 weeks. I think you really need to go out and get some fresh air and sunshine.
You're right. That's just what I'm thinking about.
What is the woman most probably going to do?
Question 5.
Hello, John. How are you feeling now? I hear you've been ill.
They must have confused me with my twin brother, Rod. He's been sick all week, but I've never felt better in my life.
What do we learn about the man?
Question 6.
Did you really give away all your furniture when you moved into the new house last month?
Just the useless pieces. As I'm planning to purchase a new set from Italy for the sitting room only.
What does the woman mean?
Question 7.
I've brought back your Oxford Companion to English Literature. I thought you might use it for your paper. sorry not to have returned it earlier.
I was wondering where that book was.
What can we infer from the conversation?
Question 8.
To tell the truth, Tony, it never occurred to me that you're an athlete.
Oh, really? Most people who meet me, including some friends of mine, don't think so either.
What do we learn from the conversation? Now you'll hear the two long conversations. Conversation 1.
Mary, I hope you're packed and ready to leave.
Yes, I'm packed, but not quite ready. I can't find my passport.
Your passport? That's the one thing you mustn't leave behind.
I know. I haven't lost it. I've packed it, but I can't remember which bag it's in.
Well, you'll have to find it at the airport. Come on, the taxi's waiting.
Did you say taxi? I thought we were going in your car.
Yes, well, I had planned to, but I'll explain later. You've got to be there in an hour.
The plane doesn't leave for 2 hours. Anyway, I'm ready to go now.
Now, you're taking just one case, is that right?
No, there's one in the hall as well.
Gosh, what a lot of stuff. You're taking enough for a month instead of a week.
Well, you can't depend on the weather. It might be cold.
It's never cold in Rome. Certainly not in May. Come on, we really must go.
Right. We're ready. We've got the bags. I'm sure there's no need to rush.
There is. I asked the taxi driver to wait 2 minutes, not 20.
Look, I'm supposed to be going away to relax. You're making me nervous.
Well, I want you to relax on holiday, but you can't relax yet.
Okay, I promise not to relax. At least not until we get to the airport and I find my passport.
Questions 9 to 12 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 9.
What does the woman say about her passport?
Question 10.
What do we know about the woman's trip?
Question 11.
Why does the man urge the woman to hurry?
Question 12.
Where does the conversation most probably take place? Conversation 2.
Oh, I'm fed up with my job.
Hey, there's a perfect job for you in the paper today. You might be interested.
Oh? What is it? What do they want?
Wait a minute. Ah, here it is. The European Space Agency is recruiting translators.
The European Space Agency?
Well, that's what it says. They need an English translator to work from French or German.
So they need a degree in French or German, I suppose. Well, I've got that. What's more, I have plenty of experience. What else are they asking for?
Just that. A university degree and 3 or 4 years' experience as a translator in a professional environment. They also say the person should have a lively and inquiring mind, effective communication skills, and the ability to work individually or as a part of the team.
Well, if I stay at my present job much longer, I won't have any mind or skills left. By the way, what about salary? I just hope it isn't lower than what I get now.
It's said to be negotiable. It depends on the applicant's education and experience. In addition to basic salary, there's a list of extra benefits. Have a look yourself.
Travel and social security plus relocation expenses are paid. Hey, this isn't bad. I really want the job.
Questions 13 to 15 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 13.
Why is the woman trying to find a new job?
Question 14.
What position is being advertised in the paper?
Question 15.
What are the key factors that determine the salary of the new position? Section B. Directions. In this section, you will hear 3 short passages. At the end of each passage, you will hear some questions. Both the passage and the questions will be spoken only once. After you hear a question, you must choose the best answer from the 4 choices marked A, B, C, and D. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center.
Passage 1. When couples get married, they usually plan to have children. Sometimes, however, a couple cannot have a child of their own. In this case, they may decide to adopt a child. In fact, adoption is very common today. There are about 60,000 adoptions each year in the United States alone. Some people prefer to adopt infants. Others adopt older children. Some couples adopt children from their own countries. Others adopt children from foreign countries. In any case, they all adopt children for the same reason. They care about children and want to give their adopted child a happy life. Most adopted children know that they are adopted. Psychologists and child care experts generally think this is a good idea. However, many adopted children, or adoptees, have very little information about their biological parents. As a matter of fact, it is often very difficult for adoptees to find out about their birth parents because the birth records of most adoptees are usually sealed. The information is secret, so no one can see it. Naturally, adopted children have different feelings about their birth parents. Many adoptees want to search for them, but others do not. The decision to search for birth parents is a difficult one to make. Most adoptees have mixed feelings about finding their biological parents. Even though adoptees do not know about their natural parents, they do know that their adoptive parents want them, love them, and will care for them.
Questions 16 to 19 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 16.
According to the speaker, why do some couples adopt children?
Question 17.
Why is it difficult for adoptees to find out about their birth parents?
Question 18.
Why do many adoptees find it hard to make the decision to search for their birth parents?
Question 19.
What can we infer from the passage? Passage 2. Catherine Graham graduated from the University of Chicago in 1938 and got a job as a news reporter in San Francisco. Catherine's father used to be a successful investment banker. In 1933, he bought a failing newspaper, The Washington Post. Then Catherine returned to Washington and got a job editing letters in her father's newspaper. She married Philip Graham, who took over his father-in-law's position shortly after, and became publisher of the Washington Post. But for many years, her husband suffered from mental illness, and he killed himself in 1963. After her husband's death, Catherine operated the newspaper. In the 1970s, the newspaper became famous around the world, and Catherine was also recognized as an important leader in newspaper publishing. She was the first woman to head a major American publishing company, the Washington Post Company. In a few years, she successfully expanded the company to include newspaper, magazine, broadcast, and cable companies. She died of head injuries after a fall when she was 84. More than 3,000 people attended her funeral, including many government and business leaders. Her friends said she would be remembered as a woman who had an important influence on events in the United States and the world. Catherine once wrote, "The world without newspapers would not be the same kind of world." After her death, the employees of the Washington Post wrote, "The world without Catherine will not be the same at all."
Questions 20 to 22 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 20.
What do we learn from the passage about Catherine's father?
Question 21.
What does the speaker tell us about Catherine Graham?
Question 22.
What does the comment by employees of the Washington Post suggest? Passage 3. Obtaining good health insurance is a real necessity while you are studying overseas. It protects you from minor and major medical expenses that can wipe out not only your savings, but your dreams of an education abroad. There are often two different types of health insurance you can consider buying: international travel insurance and student insurance in the country where you will be going. An international travel insurance policy is usually purchased in your home country before you go abroad. It generally covers a wide variety of medical services, and you are often given a list of doctors in the area where you will travel who may even speak your native language. The drawback might be that you may not get your money back immediately. In other words, you may have to pay all your medical expenses and then later submit your receipts to the insurance company. On the other hand, getting student health insurance in the country where you will study might allow you to only pay a certain percentage of the medical cost at the time of service, and thus you don't have to have sufficient cash to pay the entire bill at once. Whatever you decide, obtaining some form of health insurance is something you should consider before you go overseas. You shouldn't wait until you are sick with major medical bills to pay off.
Questions 23 to 25 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 23.
Why does the speaker advise overseas students to buy health insurance?
Question 24.
What is the drawback of students buying international travel insurance?
Question 25.
What does the speaker say about students getting health insurance in the country where they will study? Section C. Directions. In this section, you will hear a passage three times. When the passage is read for the first time, you should listen carefully for its general idea. When the passage is read for the second time, you are required to fill in the blanks with the exact words you have just heard. Finally, when the passage is read for the third time, you should check what you have written. Now, listen to the passage.
More and more of the world's population are living in towns or cities. The speed at which cities are growing in the less developed countries is alarming. Between 1920 and 1960, big cities in developed countries increased 2.5 times in size. But in other parts of the world, the growth was 8 times their size. The sheer size of growth is bad enough, but there are now also very disturbing signs of trouble in the comparison of percentages of people living in towns and percentages of people working in industry. During the 19th century, cities grew as a result of the growth of industry. In Europe, the proportion of people living in cities was always smaller than that of the workforce working in factories. Now, however, the reverse is almost always true in the newly industrialized world. The percentage of people living in cities is much higher than the percentage working in industry. Without a base of people working in industry, These cities cannot pay for their growth. There is not enough money to build adequate houses for the people that live there, let alone the new arrivals. There has been little opportunity to build water supplies or other facilities. So the figures for the growth of towns and cities represent proportional growth of unemployment and underemployment, a growth in the number of hopeless and despairing parents and starving children.
Now the passage will be read again. More and more of the world's population are living in towns or cities. The speed at which cities are growing in the less developed countries is alarming. Between 1920 and 1960, big cities in developed countries increased 2.5 times in size. But in other parts of the world, the growth was 8 times their size. The sheer size of growth is bad enough, but there are now also very disturbing signs of trouble in the comparison of percentages of people living in towns and percentages of people working in industry. During the 19th century, cities grew as a result of the growth of industry. In Europe, the proportion of people living in cities was always smaller than that of the workforce working in factories. Now, however, the reverse is almost always true in the newly industrialized world. The percentage of people living in cities is much higher than the percentage working in industry. Without a base of people working in industry, these cities cannot pay for their growth. There is not enough money to build adequate houses for the people that live there, let alone the new arrivals. There has been little opportunity to build water supplies or other facilities. So the figures for the growth of towns and cities represent proportional growth of unemployment and underemployment, a growth in the number of hopeless and despairing parents and starving children.
Now the passage will be read for the third time. More and more of the world's population are living in towns or cities. The speed at which cities are growing in the less developed countries is alarming. Between 1920 and 1960, big cities in developed countries increased 2.5 times in size. But in other parts of the world, the growth was 8 times their size. The sheer size of growth is bad enough, but there are now also very disturbing signs of trouble in the comparison of percentages of people living in towns and percentages of people working in industry. During the 19th century, cities grew as a result of the growth of industry. In Europe, the proportion of people living in cities was always smaller than that of the workforce working in factories. Now, however, the reverse is almost always true in the newly industrialized world. The percentage of people living in cities is much higher than the percentage working in industry. Without a base of people working in industry, these cities cannot pay for their growth. There is not enough money to build adequate houses for the people that live there, let alone the new arrivals. There has been little opportunity to build water supplies or other facilities. So the figures for the growth of towns and cities represent proportional growth of unemployment and underemployment, a growth in the number of hopeless and despairing parents and starving children.
This is the end of listening comprehension.